Hello, and welcome to Episode 3 of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, as well as interviews with artists and creators across the county. That's the banjo picking of Greg Cahill, the founder of the bluegrass group The Special Consensus, tearing it up on the Michael Martin Murphy classic Carolina in the Pines. I'll be talking with Greg about the group's appearance at the Opera House on October 22nd, later on in the podcast. I'll also be speaking with Dr. Jessica Hillman-McCord and her choreographer, the fabulous Jen Cody, about their production of Andrew Lippa's musical The Wild Party, the first Walter Gluer mainstage production from the Department of Theater and Dance at SUNY Fredonia. But first off, let's travel a little further back in time to discuss one of the great High Renaissance master painters, whose works will be shown in the documentary exhibition Raphael Revealed on October 16th at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. To celebrate the 500th anniversary of his death, the largest collection of Raphael's work ever assembled was brought to Rome and subsequently filmed by award-winning director Phil Grabsky for exhibition on screen. I was lucky enough to get nationally recognized artist Alberto Rey, who was also Distinguished Professor of Art at SUNY Fredonia, to talk about the significance of Raphael's work. Alberto, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad you had the time to come and join us. Let's dive right in and talk about a little bit about the era. Raphael was a painter of the High Renaissance, and his contemporaries were both Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo. So can you speak a little bit to the period and maybe what was going on in Rome at the time, this High Renaissance era of art?
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for inviting me to be on your podcast. You know, the thing that I find fascinating about Raphael, besides his technical proficiency, is just how interesting he was and what a difficult life he led. His mother passed away when he was 8. His father passed away when he was 11. And he was kind of considered a master by the time he was 15. So he started to get commissions by that point. And then he moved from Pergola to Florence because he was influenced by the work of Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci. And as everybody knows, Florence was just a cultural center in that period of the High Renaissance, and this was kind of the beginning of that. And he was heavily influenced by Michelangelo, not only in the Madonnas that he painted during that period, but also in the lighting that he used, the chiaroscuro and the kind of the high contrast between light and dark. And especially later on in his life, his work and his murals and frescoes were heavily influenced by that rich, dark, contrasty, limited light that kind of created a really interesting mood that was evident in his work, especially his later work. Again, it was, a very rich time to be in Florence and other places. So he was invited by Julius II to leave Florence to come to Rome to do the frescoes in the Sistine Chapel. And then when Julius, his predecessor was Leo X, Leo had him, the popes had him not only continue with the murals and frescoes, but also he designed the tapestries in the Sistine Chapel, which was pretty interesting, and also did a whole bunch of portraits at that time as well. That was kind of, again, indicative and influenced by Michelangelo. And I think his last painting, the Transfiguration, which some believe was his best work, was actually finished by one of his assistants, which I find just surprising that he would consider that his best work if it was finished by somebody else. As an artist, I can't imagine somebody else finishing a piece of work of mine and considering that to be my best work. So I'm not sure how, I mean, I've read that and I'm just not sure how accurate it is. I think some details over history can get, as they say, lost in translation.
I was actually, it's interesting that you brought that particular piece up, because when you talked about how he used light and contrast, the way he does that in that particular piece, I find to be, of all of the paintings I looked at, the most striking. I mean, the Christ in that figure is incredibly full of light and everything else is so dark around it. Yeah. The composition is quite spectacular.
Yeah, you know, that piece became so popular that they decided to make it a mosaic. And after his death, and it took 9 years for them to finish that mosaic. I think it's at the St. Peter's Basilica now. But the idea that, you know, to replicate that as a mosaic and it would take that long is because it's a very complicated painting. It's, you know, just a lot of figurative work and a lot of symbolism. And I think that's the thing with the paintings is it's never just what you see, what you think you see. And the thing is, when we look at a painting from, you know, the 1500s, we see it through the eyes of individuals who are living in the, you know, early 2000s when the culture is very different, or education is very different, or exposure is very different. But back then, when you did a still life or a narrative painting, it was reflecting what was happening at the time. And I think the people who would see these paintings would appreciate it much more than I think we can, because it was much more reflective of society, and also much more reflective of issues that were going on, not only politically and religion, but also in art itself. So each painting was a move, a step forward in what was then contemporary art. You know, there's a saying that all art is contemporary, and that's true. All art that's done at that, in that period that it's done, is considered contemporary art.
We mentioned that he, you know, he died very young at 37. If he had lived, you know, even 20 more years or so, where do you think he would have ended up in terms of painters throughout history?
I think he was just, it seemed to me that he was just beginning to figure things out. I mean, in a way that was innovative for that period, not only with the lighting that we talked about, but also, you know, he was also an interesting guy, because he was interested in archaeology. And towards the latter part of his life, he was the commissioner of antiquities, and he was in charge of all art projects in Rome. And so I think that combination, kind of that interdisciplinary interests, would have provided some interesting things, as it did for Leonardo da Vinci. And it's hard to tell what would have happened. But again, he died when he was 37. Leonardo da Vinci died when he was 67. And Michelangelo died when he was 88. So, I mean, that is a huge difference. And as an artist myself, you know, I'm 60 years old, 61. And there's something that happens later on in life when you have all your facilities and you have all your techniques down, that you can just concentrate on the message more, because you have a skill set that you don't have to necessarily, it's not that you don't have to work at, but it's there already. So you just concentrate on the message. And I think he was just kind of getting to that point. And I think there's some darkness in some of his paintings at the end. It's hard to say that if he saw that the end was coming, but I think he was willing to take chances with his work that he wasn't taking earlier on, because he wanted to become recognized and he wanted to be more financially stable. So he was creating work that was a little bit more popular, or a little bit more acceptable. And I think as you get older, you realize that, you know, you can take some more chances.
Oh, great. Listen, thanks for coming on the podcast. I really do appreciate it. And before I go, I want you to let the audience, the listening audience, know you've got an exhibition coming up pretty soon,
sure,
too, don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, I have it's an interesting exhibition at the Buffalo Museum of Science. It opens up on the 16th. And this is the first time the Museum of Science has had an art exhibition that is centered on their collection. And so it's kind of a rare opportunity to look at the, what I did is I have small, we selected very small artifacts from their almost a million pieces that they have in their collection. And we picked 15 that were culturally or scientific importance and interest. And I blew those up into 4x6 foot paintings. And there's some time-lapse videos of the paintings being created. So it's kind of an interesting combination of science, culture, and art put together in an exhibition. And there's also a publication that we did with it as well.
So it opens on October the 16th. When does it run till?
Till December 31st.
So good. So people should go up and see that. I know that it's going to be worth their while because goodness knows I've seen so much of your work and everything is always so spectacular and interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's you know, that's definitely got to be a must for some people.
Alberto, you're very kind. Thank you.
No, I'm not very kind. You're very talented.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I appreciate your time. You take care. I'll be talking to you.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. My thanks to Alberto for taking the time for this interview and sharing his insights on the work of Raphael. The Art and Architecture Series presentation of Raphael Revealed will be shown at the Opera House on Saturday, October 16th at 1 p.m. Also coming up this weekend and next weekend, the Cinema Series presents two intriguing films. The first, On Broadway, is an inside look at the inner workings of Broadway theater, complete with interviews from Broadway luminaries past and present, while the movie 23 Walks presents a comedic and heartwarming look at love in later life. Finally, the Live at the Met series is showing its second production, the groundbreaking Fire Shut Up in My Bones, on Saturday, October the 23rd at 1 p.m. For more information on any of these events, call the box office at 716-679-1891 or visit the website at www.fredopera.org.
Show them your muscles.
Nah, I don't.
Show them your muscles. It's hard to express how.
Jen Cody was one of those students you really did not teach how to do anything. Whatever it is, she has it. You simply tried to give her as many opportunities as possible and enjoyed the results. After mesmerizing audiences on the Marvel stage, she has gone on to mesmerize Broadway and regional audiences across the country. She originated the role of May in the off-Broadway musical The Wild Party by Andrew Lippa, and has returned to create the choreography for the production, which is opening on October 22nd in the Marvel Theater. Despite her busy schedule, Jen offered her time, along with director Dr. Jessica Hillman McCord, to discuss their upcoming production. Well, I can't really say how excited I am to have both of you. Jessica Hillman McCord, the director of The Wild Party, great to have you here. And Jen Cody, welcome, bienvenue, welcome. Good to have you both.
Thank you.
How about let's start with Jessica, and perhaps you can give us a little bit of background, how the show was chosen, what the process was, and how you managed to convince Jen to come up here and choreograph for us.
Well, I think, thank goodness she did, because that was one of the main reasons for choosing this show. I thought maybe we could get Jen to come. And I don't know how we would have done it without her. I don't think we could have done it without her. So thank goodness she, you know, I think partly just due to COVID scheduling, had a little bit of a block where she could come. Choreography, I thought, might be a little simpler schedule-wise to be able to get Jen here. And I've always loved the score for this show, and it's great challenges for the student actors. And after a year where we weren't able to do any live performance, it, you know, it felt like there should be a big musical with singing and dancing and big acting challenges. So it for a bunch of reasons, it seemed like a good option. But again, thank goodness we had Jen. So yes, it's a big way to come back.
Wow, great. Now, Jen, you were in the original off-Broadway production of this show, and it had a cast of luminaries like you can't believe. Julia Murney, Brian D'Arcy James, Taye Diggs, Idina Menzel. So how was that experience for you? You were getting into this cast with all these people, and here we go. What was the experience like to open up an original Broadway show like that?
It was thrilling. We were all youngins, and we created it from the ground up, which was the first time I'd ever done that. And, you know, it started at Manhattan Theater Club off Broadway. I think everyone had the intention that it would move. That was just, we would do it and then it would have its little run and then we'd move to Broadway. And at the same time, the material itself went into public domain. So at the same time, another writer was writing another Wild Party, actually strangely connected to Fredonia a little bit because John Lacutia went to school with me when I was there. His brother, Michael John Lacutia, is the one who wrote the musical. And Tom Lacutia, right? Tom?
Yeah. Yes, it was Tom. Yeah, Tom Lacutia was a student here.
Yeah, and his brother wrote the other Wild Party that was happening at the exact same time. And that had a cast of, Eartha Kitt and Mark Kudish and
Mandy Patinkin.
And so that one opened, I think, about 3 weeks after us. And it was like, you know, hindsight is 2020. Had we waited, I think we would have had a better chance. But I think the producers thought, oh, we'll go first and we'll blow it out of the water with these young, exciting people. And, the show probably could have used a couple more weeks of rehearsal. I mean, we put it up very quickly. And I look back because I think the original intent was to keep working on the show and make it better. And we just didn't have the time. That opened and we actually both shows were destroyed.
Well, when I was doing my research, I was really curious to find out who the choreographer was for that show. And it was a gentleman by the name of Marcus Dendy. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And he won an Obie for his choreography. What did you gain from his work?
Well, it's interesting. It was his first Broadway show, even though it was an off Broadway show. And he had never worked in having to have like numbers on the floor or consistent choreography where other people could recreate it. You know, he's used to working in a modern art form. And I was his dance captain. So it was a little frustrating, but he's wildly creative. And I actually went on to do Taboo with him on Broadway a couple of years later. He's one of those idiot savants a little bit where he's just so creative. And that was thrilling to not think of movement that wasn't movement that we knew, you know?
When so you come nice. Back to it now to choreograph it here after, over like close to 20, 21 years now from doing the original.
Hey, hush.
Oh, sorry.
I'm just kidding.
what of your flavor of choreography? What do you think you're putting in that you think is really, you know, it's really a mark of Jen Cody?
I think honestly, I'm tiny and that makes my choreography, I think, a little more athletic much more quicker, maybe. I think some of the taller dancers might be like, it's too fast. but I hope that I bring an energy to it that, I've been really pulling from 1920s and 1930s choreography, trying to bring elements of that and show students how you can take iconic dance moves and yet update them and make them feel fresh. That was kind of my whole thing coming in. So that was what I hope to achieve.
And Jen's choreography is amazing. I think everyone needs to see the show just for the dances alone. And she's bringing amazing things out of the students who have to really rise to that level. And they really are working so hard.
They are
they're
working.
Doing a great job. And it's really
And I had to say, I was nervous. And then when we talked about auditions, I said, I want to have a dance call. And so on Zoom, I taught a dance. We sent it to the students. They all learned it. The whole department learned this dance.
Wow.
And put themselves back on tape and sent it back to me. And I mean, that's when I kind of knew, like, oh, I think it's going to be fine, because they worked so hard on just the dance audition.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Jessica, give us a bit of background on what the show is about, actually. The people who are not familiar with The Wild Party can get a little plot synopsis and so on.
And Jen can help me. It's based on a poem by Joseph Moncure March from the 20s. And it's about a wild party. It's about show people. They're vaudeville performers and Queenie and Burrs, who are in a very abusive relationship. It's adult material. And basically in trying to get revenge on him, she decides to throw a party and basically try to make him jealous. But then her friend Kate comes with her sort of new fling named Mr. Black, and Queenie and Mr. Black form an actual real connection. And then things go terribly awry. It's dark and sad, but at the same time, extremely entertaining. And there's some really funny stuff along the way, but it is it's got the real feeling of that jazz era. It's sort of like, it has a real cabaret feeling as well. Mm-hmm. So that's the kind of overarching story. I don't want to give too much away.
Right.
The thrilling part of doing this as a performer, and probably as an audience member as well, is that there are very few shows where you are in the show from the start to the finish. You are seeing it in real time. Right. And I think that actually, at least for an actor, and I hope that the students have this experience, is that you can lose yourself in the work. You don't have to keep going off stage and changing a costume and, you know, getting water and talking to people about like what you're doing tomorrow and then coming back on stage. You are in it on the journey. And I think the audience is too. And it's not just about that story. It's about all the other stories that are happening on stage, because you're seeing the relationships build in the 2 hours. And that's what I loved about doing the show. And I think it's exciting to watch something happen in real time.
I think it's it is a unique score in that way. And I don't think Lippa has less sung through stuff since. I mean, he's really explored different styles. Jen knows him, so she's been able to contact him with a few questions that we had, which again is a huge resource for us.
Oh, that's great. What did you ask him, Jen?
Oh, he was great. There were some like notations in the score and stuff that we just didn't understand, you know, words that are not just not musical words. And so I would text him and say, hey, what does Ricky Ticky mean? Or what? And he so lovely would get right back to me. And it was really sweet. I've asked him a couple questions about the score.
Well, you know, being an oldie, I remember having the experience of when I directed Rent for the college. And I remember going, oh my gosh, Rent, I really felt out of my element when I got the assignment, but I said, okay, well, I'm going to try it. And I remember about halfway or three quarters of the way through the rehearsal process, I became so excited because I saw the students were so excited about that particular musical. And I got to believe that between, you know, having Jen Cody as the choreographer, Jessica working with you, that they have to be out of their minds with excitement for this show.
They're super thrilled by working with Jen. And we've had her not only on the show, but also coming into classes and working with our students there. It's a huge opportunity for them, and they know it. Luckily they're aware of how great it is, and they're super starstruck but incredibly excited and have just gotten so much out of it.
But I have to say I also have gotten a lot, because you know, a lot of times I come in and I'll do a master class at a college or I'll choreograph at a college. I've never been there for a chunk of time where I'm doing both. And so I'm seeing the students at work in class, and then I'm seeing them working at night, knowing full well I've just given them all this material to learn in class, but yet they know that they have, you know, two songs to get through tonight, and I have a lot of choreography. And it's been thrilling for me just because I see them working. And I come home and I'm like, oh my gosh, and so-and-so did this today. And even last night I watched another run-through on the Zoom, and I haven't seen a run-through in a week or a little over a week. And the growth just from where I saw them last on Zoom to this, it was so big. And yeah, I'm thrilled because I feel like, oh, wow, you know, I'm talking to students and I'm hopefully inspiring them to do this and to, you know, be focused and work really hard and don't be just wanting fame and fortune, like want to be good at what you do. And so hopefully it's they're making me better as well.
Well, you know, just from a personal point of view, I can't thank you enough for coming and helping with the current students at Fredonia. You've always been so great to the department and you've given us so much over, you know, all of the years in so many ways that I can't even count. What other department gets somebody who's been in Cats, Grease, Beauty and the Beast, Seussical, You're in Town, Shrek, I mean.
Princess and the Frog.
Yeah, Princess and the Frog and all of those kinds of things. And the last two things I saw you in were as Patsy in Spamalot, which was terrific. And then, of course, and what a lot of people don't know about you is that you're a terrific dramatic actress as well. And when you did Sylvia at Jiva, it was also just watching you just act, not singing, not dancing, just acting.
Thank you. Well, that was Fredonia.
Okay, so give me one memory that you have of your Broadway career that you think really just kind of stands out every time you think about it.
Jen has so many good stories. I don't know how she's...
every time something happens, I'm like, oh, I have a story. You know, it's funny because I wouldn't have thought this when you said that. Like, I thought, oh, I'm going to have a story about You're in Town probably. But the first thing that came to my mind was standing backstage waiting to dance the big number in Pajama Game at the Tony Awards. For some reason, that's what came into my head. So I'm going to say that because, yeah, it was thrilling to do that. And I guess that my memory is saying that's been the most exciting thing. But that could change tomorrow. I don't know. But right now, that's what is in my head.
Well, with everybody sitting there at the Tony Awards, you've got, you know, all the royalty of Broadway sitting there watching you. I guess I would be the same way.
It's Radio City, right? And I, you know, and it was a group of people that we were together. I think that was probably one of the highlights.
Jen wow, is great. Royalty of Broadway. She doesn't have to be racist. She is.
So the Wild Party kicks off on October 22nd and 23rd at 7:30 p.m. And then there's a matinee on October 24th at 2 p.m. And then it runs another weekend from October 28th to the 30th at 7:30 p.m. in the Marvel Theater at the Rockefeller Arts Center on the campus of SUNY Fredonia. And it's an adult show. So I do want to warn the audience that, you know, it's an adult show with adult themes. So do keep that in consideration as you think of who's going to the show or even yourself going to the show. Any last words, ladies?
Come and see the work these students are doing. We have fought through so much. quarantining and masks and
I mean they're putting on a show and they're wearing masks and they're trying to act and sing through these masks and on top of that they're learning a show so quickly and it's a huge show and it's emotional and like it's everything that we've thrown at them they have 2 weeks to show and be proud of. So
that's excellent. All right, ladies, thank you so much. Best of luck to you. Hopefully I'll get a chance to see you in person sometime soon.
Thanks very much for having us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. My thanks to Jen and to Dr. Hillman McCord, both for taking the time from their intense rehearsal period to discuss the show. Once again, audiences should be aware that the show contains adult themes and adult situations and is aimed at a mature audience.
We're happy together.
Everyone's got guilty pleasures, right? Well, one of mine is bluegrass music. The sheer virtuosity of the instrumental stylings in bluegrass music always leaves me in awe. And one of the greatest banjo stylists in the world of bluegrass, Greg Cahill, will be coming to the 1891 Fredonia Opera House with the group he founded back in 1975, the Special Consensus. It was my lucky day when I got the chance to speak with Greg and find out why a Chicago boy dedicated his life to playing bluegrass. Mr. Greg Cahill, I cannot tell you how stoked I am to have you on my podcast. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thanks a million, Tim. I appreciate it and happy to be here with you.
Great. So you just came off a really big weekend around your new album, Chicago Barn Dance, and you had a bunch of alumni from Special C come out to Chicago, I think it is, and play and have a good time. Can you tell us about it?
Well, let's see. The 2020 was the 45-year anniversary of the formation of Special C as a touring and recording band. And so I think our 10-year anniversary, we had a little gathering of people who had been in the band by that point. So then we decided every 5 years we try to do that and get people together, you know. So starting with the 15th, we've done every 5 years at the Old Town School of Folk Music. We try to get as many of the people who have been on the recordings, who were in the band at the time we made a recording. And the set list is basically one or two songs from each recording with as many people who were actually on that recording there. So now this time, and then of course, for the 45th anniversary, which was last year, it was, we had to reschedule it, you know, they were for indoor shows, it wasn't a wise thing to do with COVID. So it was rescheduled for the other day, Saturday, October 9th. And we had about 15 people come in, you know, including our current band members. And we went through Chicago Barn Dance, which was released in March of 2020. With that release, that was our 20th band release. So we had 20 recordings. We had all these folks fly in and drive in and whatever, and just had a great show.
Let me ask you how a Chicago boy got interested in bluegrass. I think that's a kind of an interesting thing. I know you were born and raised in Chicago, and all of a sudden from the city that's known for blues, we have a bluegrass player. How'd you get interested in that type of music?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question, Tom. When I was graduating from high school, living here on the southwest side of Chicago, one of my friends showed up with a senior picnic, and one of my friends showed up with a banjo. I had no idea he played the banjo, but I was really always fascinated with stringed instruments. So when my friend showed up with a 5-string banjo, I bought the long neck banjo. Then I was into I heard Earl Scruggs. I was like, man, how many people are playing that banjo? That's amazing. And all of this also dovetails with the reason we did the recording and called it the Chicago Barn Dance, because there has been country and bluegrass music here for a long time. And the story behind that is that in the 20s, late 20s, WLS radio station sponsored the National Barn Dance, and it was a radio program. And they brought in all, for the radio broadcast, all the country stars of the day. But there were these two brothers who moved from Kentucky to work in the refineries in Indiana, Gary, Indiana, and they would drive in as dancers, Bill and Charlie Monroe. That's how they started on the show, as dancers, you know. They were great dancers. And then they eventually, of course, became Bill and Charlie Monroe's duet team. And the show was so popular that it moved to the 8th Street Theater here in Chicago, and it became a live show, and people would pack in, I mean, stand in line for hours to get in, even in January when it's really cold here. And the announcer for that show for a number of years, the live show of the 8th Street Theater, was George D. Hay, the solemn old judge. And he left Chicago and moved to Nashville, and then went to work for WSM, and then became the program director and said, hey, you know, we need a good show that'll really bring the music to the people. We need a show like that show back in Chicago, the Barn Dance. So let's do that, and let's call it the Grand Ole Opry. To replace the Grand Opera show. And so there you go. And so the roots of all of that was from Chicago. And so that's, hence everything on the Chicago Barn Dance recording is a song that was either written by somebody who lived here or who moved here and, you know, performed here and what have you, or wrote songs about Chicago, whatever. So every song has some connect to Chicago in that way. And the title cut was written by our great friends, Becky Buller and Missy Raines and Allison Brown. And they really researched it, because if you listen to the words of that song, everything and all the names they mention are people who were on that show and part of the show. So that's a long-winded explanation of how I got into bluegrass music, but the fact that there was bluegrass and country music in Chicago for a long time. And the whole impetus for doing this, you know, each time we record for Compass Records, and we love, that's our family, you know, we've had been working with and have Allison Brown produces us. So she's just a phenomenal producer as well as musician. But for probably the first 35 years of Special C, we had a hard time getting booked at festivals and stuff, because people would say, you're from Chicago, you can't know anything about bluegrass, you'll never play this music the right way, you can't, you just don't even know. And so it was like, doggone it, it's 45 years and I'm gonna figure out a way to let people know that it's not so weird to be from Chicago and play bluegrass.
Well, you've proven them wrong. I mean, you've got 2 Grammy nominations. You've got a Distinguished Achievement Award from the International Bluegrass Music Association. So I think you've proven your point.
Well, I'm very honored and very surprised about all of that, you know, and that's great to have your peers recognize that.
You've mentioned Flat and Scruggs as big influences. You got any others that over the years that you've I really admired their playing and have influenced your own playing?
There were many, for sure. J.D. Crowe, I mean, he didn't realize it at the time, but he was pretty much my mentor. I would be the guy standing at the back of the stage when he'd come off at a festival, and I was the guy, J.D., you didn't play that solo on what you just played when you played Rolling My Sweet Bag. That's not what you played on the recording. He was so gracious. So J.D. Crowe, and actually Jethro Burns. I lived about 4 or 5 blocks from Jethro Burns for about 18 years in Evanston, Illinois. And we became friends, and he was just, I mean, the maestro of the mandolin, and it was through him when people like Sam Bush would come to town with the Bluegrass Revival or David Grisman. They'd all go visit Jethro, and I met a lot of them just because I was friends with Jethro. He was befriended me and as well, and I was honored. I did a solo recording in 1980, and Jethro graciously played on it. And that's why, I mean, I didn't know what I was doing, you know. So I had a lot of different influences from different places, but really, you know, of course, Bill Monroe and his music, as I said, Flat and Scruggs, J.D. Crowe, Bela Fleck, Tony Trischka, Bill Keith, Alan Mundy. I mean, I listened to so many banjo players, and not just, I mean, you know, and Tony Rice and his beautiful music, Vassar Clements. I mean, he would come through town. I got to play with him sometimes, and he would just put together a band in town. You know. So,
wow.
A mixed bag.
You want to talk, let's finish up by talking a little bit about your traditional American music program that you started. I'm really interested in that. What's that all about? How'd you get that going?
This was back in the early 80s. And I just had a teacher friend that asked me if I would come into her classroom. They were studying, you know, roots music in America, and bring the banjo. So I did. And of course, a lot of kids have never seen a banjo close up, and they just said, wow, and played some tunes. And of course, then the other teachers in that school heard about this and would come down, hey, can you come to my class next week? And so on. And then teachers in other schools in the area were like, well, how about coming to our school? You know, I could work that out. And I was just doing it for free, just because I thought it'd be great to have kids see the banjo and learn about bluegrass music. And eventually, you know, and in fact, Chris Jones was in the band at the time, and I asked him to come along with me one time. I said, sure. And so we went and played, and pretty soon we were going as a band. And it became clear that there was real interest in this by the kids and the teachers. And it dovetailed with their study of roots music and where, how it even was right there in Chicago, you know. So I went to the library. This was way before internet or anything like that, you know, went to the library and just researched, bluegrass music and wrote up a study guide for the teachers, just a few pages, and then found sketches, pictures of each instrument and describe the instrument and how it's played and made. And then we developed a regular presentation, which was really meant to introduce students to bluegrass music as a roots music. And we called it the Traditional American Music Program, the TAM program. And then I applied for some funding from one of the arts councils here, and we got it. And so we did it for a number. We still do it occasionally in the schools, but back then there was arts funding for it. It was great. And at one point, somebody asked, you know, well, how many kids do you think you've been in front of? And I tried to go through all the records I had of the different programs. And we truly, after, you know, 20 years of doing this, had been in front of a million kids, students, just telling them about bluegrass music, you know. So, and then when I was on the board of the IBMA, the International Bluegrass Music Association, I was on a committee, the Bluegrass in the Schools Committee, and Nancy Cardwell and I kind of molded this program into the concept of a video that we made. It was called Discover Bluegrass. So it's still alive and well. Hopefully still reaching a lot of the young folks.
I think it's a great way to get that tradition alive and keep it going and all of that type of stuff. Bluegrass is I just enjoy listening to it. And I know that the people in Fredonia and the Dunkirk area and Northern Chautauqua County are going to enjoy your special C when you guys come out. It's really, we're looking forward to that show, Greg. So thanks a lot for your time. I know you got a million other things to do, but I really do appreciate you coming on for a little bit and talking to us here.
Well, it's great. My pleasure. Thank you, Tom. And I hope we get to visit with a lot of the folks in Fredonia. We're looking forward to that show. We've been there before, as you know, and just everybody there is so nice, and the staff and the people who come out to hear the music. It's a real treat for us. So looking forward to it.
Great. We'll see you when you get here. Take care, Greg.
Yeah, you too. Thanks, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Greg's schedule was incredibly packed when I reached out to ask about the interview. So I want to doubly thank him for taking the time he probably didn't have to speak with me. You really have to get out and see the Special Consensus on Friday, October 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. You won't regret it a bit. That's it for this week's episode. Once again, I want to thank this week's guests, Professor Alberto Ray, Dr. Jessica Hillman McCord, Broadway royalty Jen Cody, and Mr. Greg Cahill from the Special Consensus, playing us out with the Chicago-born Steve Goodman classic, City of New Orleans. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a presentation of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891 or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Notes from the Aisle Seat. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another.